This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 24th of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 124th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. This week we're turning the page. We've got a bit of a literary theme going on, but don't judge us by our cover. Crack the spine and delve deep into chapter one. We'll kick things off with Tom Rob Smith, whose new thriller, The Farm, explores the darkness lurking in Swedish storytelling and is more autobiographical than you might first think.
In a strange sense, it's a thriller. It seems like an object that is very removed from my life, but it felt like it was really sort of scooped out of my soul.
We'll also hear who's made the shortlist for this year's International Prize for Arabic Fiction and ask Boston Globe literary critic Matthew Gilbert what's on his reading list.
It's by Scott Stossel, who is the editor of The Atlantic and a hugely successful man who has terrible, debilitating, paralyzing anxiety.
But it's not all about books. We'll also be hearing how the punk rock scene is breaking new ground in Cambodia. We'll get the latest on the Spanish art market at this year's ARCO, enjoy Midori House session from the amazing Anna Calvi, and hear how Syrian artists have been finding a new home in Beirut.
Lebanon has embraced all the artists, galleries has opened for Syrian art. You see many exhibitions monthly. People are more aware of the Syrian art nowadays.
So what we're saying is block out your diary for the next 53 minutes and join me, Robert Bounds, right here on Culture on Monocle 24. First up, then, is that their session, which this week comes from a female artist once famously described as the best thing since Patti Smith by none other than Brian Eno. Anna Calvi, whose soaring guitars and brooding lyrics won her the respect of music journalists the world over following her 2011 debut, is back. Her second release, One Breath, came out at the end of last year, and she's currently on tour across Europe. She swung by to see us here at Midori House to give us a little taster. So here she is first with Eliza.
Lonely won't hold me for good. Peaceful as dreaming, she stood. To see her, to be her, to change. As if like a kiss we're the same. So hold me up, hold me up. If only I could be. La 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 la
That was Anna Calvi performing here at Midori House for us with Eliza from her new album, One Breath. And we'll enjoy more of Anna and her powerhouse of a voice later on in the show. Who knows what the book of the year might be? Who decides anyway? But one thing's for sure, on ours and many a critical list will be The Farm by Tom Robb Smith. A wonderfully tense, strange and transporting thriller about a son who receives a panicked and paranoid visit from his mother as she recollects the dark goings-on at the farm in the remote Swedish countryside where she and her husband have moved from London to what they believe to be an idyllic retirement that proves to be very far from it. It's a novel that mixes arrow straight but perhaps unreliable narration with a thriller structure and a touch of voguish Nordic noir. The story will be burned into your brain and the book like glue in your hands, I reckon. I spoke to the author Tom Robb Smith about The Farm.
Until that phone call, it had been an ordinary day. Laden with groceries, I was walking home through Bermondsey, a neighbourhood of London just south of the river. It was a stifling August evening. When the phone rang, I considered ignoring it, keen to hurry home and shower. Curiosity got the better of me, so I slowed, sliding the phone out of my pocket, pressing it against my ear, sweat pooling on the screen. It was my dad. He'd recently moved to Sweden, and the call was unusual. He rarely used his mobile, and it would have been expensive to call London. My dad was crying. I came to an abrupt stop, dropping the grocery bag. I'd never heard him cry before. My parents had always been careful not to argue or lose their temper in front of me. In our household, there were no furious rows or tearful fights. I said, "Dad, your mother, she's not well." "Mum's sick?" "It's so sad." "Sad because she's sick? Sick how? How's Mum sick?" Dad was still crying, and all I could do was dumbly wait until he said, "She's been imagining things. Terrible, terrible things."
Well, the central premise is, you know, that the son is living in London and he seems like a kind of regular kind of guy, relatively happy, struggling a bit, but nothing exceptional. Mm-hmm. He gets a phone call from his dad, and his parents have retired to this farm in Sweden. And it's meant to be this, as you said, idyllic retirement, this idea of going into nature and creating a perfect sort of growing all your own food. And he gets a call from his dad saying that his mum had been institutionalized and she's insane. And she suffered a psychosis. He has to fly out straight away. And on the way to the airport, he gets a phone call from his mum saying, "Actually, everything your dad has told you is a lie. I'm not mad. Your dad is involved in a criminal conspiracy. I'm flying to London to tell you the truth." Now, obviously, in terms of a structure, then when she arrives in London, if it was self-evident that she was psychotic and she was saying stuff that clearly could never happen, then the story doesn't work. She has to tell a story that is utterly convincing. But you're saying, well, did it happen like that? Is it a question of interpretation? So that was the real balancing act in the story. You could never veer too far one way or the other. So the reader had to guess all the way through. And that was the sort of challenge of it.
And in terms of researching the book, I mean, the landscape of the farm and this idyll, in quotes, in rural Sweden, is so well drawn. I feel like I've been there. I feel like I've been up that river, for example. Is that somewhere you've been? How much of a work of imagination is that, for example?
My mum's half Swedish.
Yeah.
And the actual concept that I just described happened. I mean, that really did happen to me, which is to say, 4 years ago, I was working on Agent 6, which is the third book in the Child 44 trilogy, and I was sort of happily doing this. And I got this call from my dad saying that my mum had been institutionalized, and I then was on my way to Sweden and got the call from my mum saying, "Everything your dad's told you is a lie." And she met me at Heathrow and we went back to my apartment and she told me the story, this 4 or 5 hour narrative where my dad was involved in some kind of conspiracy and it was all about neighbours betraying. And it was utterly, I mean, I believed everything she was saying. I didn't sit there and think this is clearly nonsense and absurdist. I just was totally unsure whether my dad had done these things or not. And that was the concept that I was going to put in the center of the book, to tell a story like that where you couldn't decide between your parents, this feeling of utter uncertainty about whether your mum was ill or whether your dad was really up to terrible things. And that was the inspiration for it. So it kind of draws very heavily on that personal experience, although the story I then created was entirely fictional.
The idea of the backwoods and the woods themselves have been used many times in literature. The idea of the forest being something that can be magical and puckish, and there can be obviously a dark heart to the woods as well. Did you read around that subject, or was it really very much your experience of going into the woods in your imagination?
I mean, it's an unusual position because, you know, the trilogy that I wrote was so seeped in research. Yeah. I had to read so many history books. It was wonderful. I'm not saying it as a chore. But this really felt like it was a rip from me. I grew up in those forests in Sweden. I used to go there every summer. I know them really well. In Sweden, they're so epic. I mean, they are just enormous. You can wander in and, you know, it takes 2 days to wander through them. And you feel like there's more potential for magic in them, like you're further away from mankind or something. And the mythology of trolls. I mean, I had read, you know, I don't know how many fairy tales about trolls, and I loved them. And my mum used to always read them to me. And in a sense, that was a strange thing about the event, was that I was going back to something that hadn't happened for, say, 25 years, which is my mum telling me a story and me sitting and listening to it for 3 or 4 hours. And as a kid, you listen to these stories about trolls and you think, are they true? Or are they not true? And here again, as an adult, I was listening to a story by my mum, compulsive again, thinking, is it true? Is it not true? And now, all of that is wrapped up in the book. So in a strange sense, it's a thriller. It seems like an object that is very removed from my life, but it felt like it was really sort of scooped out of my soul.
There is very simply at the heart of the novel, perhaps, just a mum telling her son a story. It's about how much you can suspend your disbelief.
That's what it boils down to. It is a mum talking to her son. And the narrative, the two first-person narratives, the son's narrative is quite a traditional first-person narrative, you know, which we'd imagine the person talking about his feelings, his life, and then occasional speech. The mother's first-person narrative is raw speech. It is her sitting opposite you talking. It's like it's not her imagining it as transcript. It's just this communication direct. And I was trying to capture that immediacy, that feeling of someone reacting to your reactions. And that's what's so great about when you tell a story in person, is that you feed off the other person. There's this sort of interrelationship in storytelling. And so I wanted to put all that down in this book. I mean, this book goes back to that childlike experience of narrative. And that is at the heart of it. That's exactly what it's capturing, a mother talking to her son.
And is there something of Sweden's liberal grand plan? It's the way that Swedish society has been famous for being, certainly since sort of after the Second World War, that we look up to Swedish society and Scandinavian society, perhaps. And maybe there is something potentially rotten at the heart of this Scandinavian dream.
There is a really interesting tension between the sheen of Sweden, which is so perfect, and you go to the cities and they're so clean and everything is run so well, and yet, you know, like everywhere there is darkness, and so the contradiction, I think, is sharp. I mean, when you think, I don't know, New York or London, we all know, oh, there's going to be some areas where there's bad stuff happening. It's kind of like we're primed for it, whereas you think, my God, it's so perfect there, even in the cities. Well, how could it be happening? Of course, it's like anywhere else, there has a dark side.
That was Tom Rob Smith, whose new novel, The Farm, is out now in the UK, published by Simon & Schuster. A Swedish translation should be hitting shelves in Stockholm and beyond from April. Over to Spain next, where the annual contemporary art fair Arco Madrid has just come to a close. As you might remember from last year, the fair had previously been grappling with the pressures stemming from the country's economic crisis. But this year, a promising selection of big-name galleries, recent changes to the tax regime, and the odd Picasso have generated some positive buzz. Our man Liam Aldous went down to the fair in the opening days to give us his take.
I'm at Arco Madrid, where this year everyone is trying to talk positive. Arco director Carlos Urroth has been on a media blitz, talking about the return of optimism and how everyone is keen to put the economic crisis behind them. But with the paintings now hung, the installations positioned, and the gallery staff poised to sell, how much of this is wishful thinking?
I am very optimistic. I don't know the rest of the people. It's the first day. We are in the beginning of our, I think it's quite slowly, it's not as the fairs in Miami, Basel, other fairs are very fast because people know if they don't buy very quickly, they lose the piece. Here it's more slowly, but it's very interesting. I am happy.
This is Varia Baró from Sao Paulo's Baró Gallery, which is widely considered as one of the go-to galleries for Latin America's emerging artists. Spain has long maintained that it is the European gateway to Latin American art, but more recently, this title is being challenged by cities such as London. Here at the Burrow stand, Venezuelan artist Ricardo Acaide believes that strong cultural ties will always give Spain an advantage.
It seems like Spain really have Latin American culture within the culture of Spanish. So I think it's very, very important. This fair is more, I think it's the one for Europe to be involved with a Latin American art fair.
I pay a visit to one of Spain's most infamous collectors and gallery owners, Helga de Alviar. Today, Helga is in quite a good mood because she's already sold quite a few pieces.
I'm really happy because really the people are interested in the fair. The fair is very good. And you know, Carlos Urroz, the director, he worked with me over 8 years in the gallery. And he's a very good friend of mine. So we all have a helping that the fair will go ahead, and that the good galleries who came one day and they didn't come again because there were nothing to sell here because nobody bought anything, they are coming slowly, but they're coming back. And I see there are really new people, and they are selling, we are selling, and everybody is much more interested, and I'm very happy about that.
A few weeks ago, the government announced that it would be reducing the debilitating 21% sales tax on art down to 10%. However, today, gallery owners are reeling from the news that this reduced tax rate will only apply to artists selling directly to buyers. Galleries will instead be slugged by a slightly higher rate of 15.5%. With the Picasso hanging behind me valued at a cool 1.2 million euros, that's a lot of value-added tax. However, an upbeat Iñigo Navarro believes that any change to the previous system is welcome.
It changed absolutely the possibilities to be competitive in our market and, of course, in the European market.
Did this come about as a result of lots of pressure by galleries being put on the government?
Absolutely. We were fighting very, very, very hard from our associations, and I think that finally the government and, of course, Hacienda, you know, the tax government, understand that it's really important to be competitive in a European Union where you can buy very easily a painting in London or in Berlin with a tax absolutely less than before, you know, than the taxes we had before.
The international focus this year is on Finland, and 13 Finnish galleries are representing 13 of the country's contemporaries. Photographer Elina Bruteris is one of them.
Finland is rather far away, you know. We're high up in the north and we're kind of not on the road to somewhere, so we rarely get massive amounts of people coming to Finland. So if we want to get Finnish art to the more general knowledge, we sort of have to get out from Finland. And this is a great opportunity now for Finnish art scene to be presented here in such a like big volume, I would say.
Today, the message on the fairground is one of resilience. And judging by this year's more positive outlook, it's a message that is hopefully set to endure for many more years to come. For Monocle in Madrid, I'm Liam Aldous.
Thanks, Liam. And after the break, we'll be learning how Syrian artists are making a go of it in Lebanon.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got The Curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
This is Culture with Robert Bound, and we're crossing to the Middle East for the next chunk of the show. In a moment, we'll be discussing the International Prize for Arabic Literature, but first, we're headed to Lebanon. While much attention has been focused on the dire plight of more than a million Syrian refugees in the country, something else has been quietly unfolding in this tiny Middle Eastern enclave, an explosion of art and music. Syrian artists have always spent spells in the relatively liberal country, but since the war, the community has grown exponentially. Venetia Rainey sent us this report from Lebanon.
From the mic to the canvas, a burgeoning community of Syrian artists in Lebanon are finding a space to flourish that is fast turning into a home away from home. Some moved voluntarily in order to work in a more open society. Others were forced to flee due to the brutal nearly three-year-old civil war. For Syrian-Filipino rapper Nasser Shweji, aka Chino, Syria was never going to be somewhere he could make the kind of music he wanted to.
I did. My first show in Damascus was in 2001. It was just fun, you know, it's not really serious. I was like 16. My friends were older, but we didn't have like a lot of social issues to tackle. And we couldn't anyways, even if we wanted to.
In June 2008, after a spell working in Damascus as a banker, Shweji decided to focus on his rap career. Feeling it was an impossible dream in Syria, he moved to Lebanon in search of better opportunities.
Freedom of speech, freedom to say what you want. And there was already a scene developing. Over there, it was just still slow and sluggish.
And it paid off, because in Lebanon, Shweji's career has taken off. His latest, much-hyped single, OPP, explores the reasons behind why people become suicide bombers, a no-go subject in Syria.
Strap it to my chest like the dynamite in us. Boom, I'm taking my life away, they trying to take it anyway, right? Sheikh, gonna pay my family more than my job will ever pay, right? All of their heroes, bitches, a bomb. All of they see myself on heaven's gate. Don't see a better way to die. Might as well be the day, right? Don't care about the...
With cultural life in Syria at a standstill due to the fighting, Lebanon has been flooded with sculptors, painters, illustrators, and everything in between, invigorating an already vibrant local art scene.
Lebanon has embraced all the artists, galleries has opened for Syrian art. You see many exhibitions monthly. People are more aware of the Syrian art nowadays.
Raghad Madini is the founder and head of Art Residence Alay, a centre which takes in a different Syrian artist every month. Next to a crackling fire in the chilly converted stables that make up the place's studios, Mardini explains why she believes the residence is essential for nurturing Syrian creativity.
When the project was ready and finished in 2012, many friends of mine and many Syrians moved to Lebanon, and I was really very sad to see that the young generation of artists was forced to take jobs like in a restaurant or in construction, any job available to make their living. I felt it's very important to open space for the artists where they can feel safe again.
The residence was created partly due to the difficulties some Syrians face in Lebanon, from a massive jump in living costs to growing resentment towards their presence. It provides artists with full board accommodation, materials for work, contacts, and a small weekly stipend. For those who have never worked abroad before, the residence is a godsend, a quiet sanctuary away from the war where they can breathe again.
So after a few days, they start to smile, to hold the brush, and they want to work and make their art. And this moment when we stretch the canvas on the frames, I feel like it's a very challenging moment for them as well as for me.
Despite the growing security problems and the immense strain the refugee influx has placed on Lebanon, the country remains a safe haven for Syrians. It is a place where they can be creative, a place to let off steam. Tanjarat Dagat, an all-Syrian band currently making waves in Beirut, is all about letting off steam. The name Tanjarat Dagat means pressure cooker, and as drummer Danny Shukri explains, it's partly a reference to the everyday pressures their generation faces.
It's mainly social, and the social pressure will cause political, economic, sexual, wherever.
Like most Syrian artists in Lebanon, the band has had to grapple with whether or not to talk about the Syrian civil war in their work. For Shukri and his bandmates, the answer was clear. no politics, no war.
Mainly what we try to do is to give a positive vibe, and talking about war again and again and again, like, it's not giving any positive push. The point is to give people something to look for and to give a better picture for what music from Syria might sound like.
But it remains an undeniable fact that because of the war, there is much more interest in Syrian artists, both in Lebanon and elsewhere. For Beirut-based conceptual artist and activist Khaled Barakeh, it's something that has tormented him since the outbreak of Syria's peaceful protests in March 2011.
I was invited many, many times to do work just because I'm Syrian. You know what I mean? Because, of course, it's Syria, it's in the news, in the media, everywhere. And I found it a bit wrong to use other people's catastrophe to get personal benefit, because at the end, of course, you get fame out of it.
Yet he found it impossible to keep the two separate, and his 24-hour online preoccupation with his country's fate soon crept into his work. The result was an exhibition of a deconstructed Syrian Daesh, the wooden stretcher used to carry dead bodies during a Muslim funeral. For rapper Shweji, the argument over referencing the war in art is much more straightforward.
I don't find it negative at all. And a lot of art comes out during struggle, you know, and then the most potent art comes out during struggle. And then the fact that people want to record this art and promote it or even shed light on it, it's always good. I don't find it negative, you know, and if it's pushing my art because of where I come from, I don't mind it.
Whether Syrian artists choose to confront the grim reality of the civil war in their work or not, their determination to keep on creating is a testimony to a side of Syria that is fast slipping out of sight. Every note, every dab of paint, serves to remind the world that there is a people behind the doom-filled headlines that is cultured, expressive, and filled with potential. And for all of the associated problems, few places in the world have embraced this reality as wholly as Lebanon. For Monocle in Beirut, I'm Venetia Rainey.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Staying in the Middle East, the International Prize for Arabic Fiction, known here in the UK as the Arabic Booker, celebrates world-class excellence in creative writing, specifically from Arabic-speaking countries. The shortlist for this year's prize was announced earlier this month in Amman, narrowing the finalists down to Yusuf Fadel, Inam Kachachi, Khalid Khalifa, Adel Rahim Lahibi, Ahmed Murad and Ahmed Sadawi. Well done. Well, we wanted to find out more about where Arabic literature is headed, so invited prize administrator Fleur Montanaro into the studio to explain all.
Two novelists from Iraq, two from Morocco, one a piece from Syria and Egypt. The youngest on the list is actually in his early 30s. He's Egyptian and a very popular writer in Egypt, a thriller writer. So that in a way was controversial, as he's not an established literary figure. The woman on the list is an Iraqi writer who is more well known, as is one of the two Moroccans who are older writers as well.
And I wonder what the sort of grand themes are. We're always tempted to think, I mean, having looked at some of the biographies of some of the people on the shortlist, clearly a lot of the parts of the world that they are from, even if they're not writing from or about, are war-torn, places of political or social strife. It's tempting to think that all Arabic fiction addresses that. It's refreshing when it's not, presumably, when you have a thriller writer, a science fiction writer, someone that maybe writes historical fiction rather than writing about the state that they're in right now.
Although these Arabic novels come from the reality and are inevitably influenced by them and the fragmentation and all the trouble that's going on in the region, they're not, in a way, a depressing read. Ahmed Sadawi, he's a documentary filmmaker, making films in quite difficult circumstances in Baghdad when he can. His novel is Frankenstein in Baghdad. It's a police hunt for this creature, Frankenstein, whose body is made up of different parts of victims of explosions which have been scattered across the city.
But that's an amazing idea for a novel.
The way he tells the story is creepy and thrilling and exciting as well as profound, and that he's giving a picture almost of modern Iraq through this creature who's taking revenge. Mm. at first in the name of justice, but then it becomes a kind of a never-ending cycle of revenge.
That sounds like an amazing idea for a book, a very kind of one idea. You know, I guess as publishers are always looking for a single great idea, this is something very easy to get one's hands on and one's mind around. I know that one of the aims of the prize is to promote the translation of Arabic fiction into English. This sounds like one of those things that might be a dead cert for that. How important is that, and how important is the ability of a writer to be able to sum up their novel in a sentence like you've done with Frankenstein in Baghdad?
It is really important. It's one of the fundamental aims of the prize. And to date, actually, we've seen novels being translated into 20 languages, including Chinese. But it is an uphill battle as well to bring Arabic literature into the forefront in the way that some other literatures are.
But is English or is Mandarin or maybe Spanish, are those the three sort of key markets that you are looking at for translation?
There has been a lot of interest in Spain, actually. There's a publisher who translates now. They publish three novels from our prize every year in Spanish. You're right, we're still hoping to break through into Mandarin and into these huge markets in South America as well. As the prize goes on, hopefully that will happen. For example, our winner last year, called The Bamboo Stalk, is about a half Kuwaiti, half Filipino young man and his problems with identity. And I'm sure that would be incredibly popular if it was read in India, for example, or in the Asian subcontinent.
Is it helpful for you to be able to talk about the region through the prism of literature, through the prism of fiction?
Yes, I think many of the writers would see the virtue, the benefit of writing is giving an alternative view, an alternative history of the region other than the one we see in the media. And certainly Khalid Khalifa has said that writing is, you know, it feels weak, but it is actually doing something useful. And yes, some of them were the Moroccan, for example, on the list. Youssef Fadel writes about prison, which is now destroyed, but in the 70s, terrible atrocities happened. And when people came out of the prison, finally after 20 years, he was shocked by what he saw and said, how could this have been happening under our noses? And from that came the novel. So it's looking into the past as well as the present as well.
That was Fleur Montanaro from the International Prize for Arabic Fiction. And the winner of the 2014 prize will be announced in Abu Dhabi on the 29th of April, the eve of the Abu Dhabi International Book Fair. Still to come in part two, we meet the woman behind The Voice. Anna Calvi will play us some tracks from her new album and join me in the studio to discuss all. And we'll find out what titles are stacked up on the bedside table of the Boston Globe's chief book critic. You'd be mad to go anywhere else. So first, back to this week's session. And before we hear from Anna Calvi herself, from her new album, One Breath, here she is live for us with Sing to Me.
So still, I am
am so still here. Sing to me, beautiful one. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Fill me up, oh, fill me whole. I'll tear my throat just to hear your.
The album feels very put together. It's very passionate, but it seems quite a considered thing. Mm. I wonder how you work. Do you come into the studio with everything sort of quite prescribed? You know exactly how you want everything to be, or is there quite a lot of work in progress?
In a way, it is very much already decided how I want it to be, but then there is a lot of kind of working stuff out in the studio as well. I think it's important to have a bit of both to really know what your vision is, but to be open for accidents to happen, because they're usually the most exciting things.
There's some lush bits on the record, some of those sort of lovely sweeping moments as well. They're obviously not the kind of things that you can be doing on a guitar. I guess you write on the guitar first, maybe. So they obviously come together in the studio. Is that something that's in your head? You're kind of like, oh, this is what this needs.
Yeah,
I'm imagining, you know, a sort of helicopter shot going across the mountains here.
I mean, like often when it's string parts, I often sing them and then they become string parts. That's usually how that works. But I also work with an arranger called Fiona Bryce, and we kind of work together. And that was really fun because it was nice to kind of get an input of someone else. Because the first record I arranged and played all the strings, and that's quite a big task. So this time I wanted to lean on someone else a little bit more.
Share the load?
Yeah.
You calling it sharing? Giving the word to someone else.
Yeah, laziness.
And in terms of touring for the One Breath, you're going all over the place. Where are rewarding places? Where do you kind of look forward to pitching up?
Well, I'm touring the UK at the moment, and that's been really enjoyable, actually. It's really nice crowds. And I'm actually really looking forward to going to Italy because I'm half Italian, and I think they
dig the
like
surname.
That. Yeah, they dig it. So I always get a very kind of rapturous reception in Italy.
Are there any amazing places in Italy we should know about? Any kind of venues that are... So I feel like there must be something that's a kind of half a beautiful ruin that you're playing that we don't know about.
Yeah, actually, it's annoying I don't remember the name of it, but there's this festival that I've done a couple of times, which is in a kind of beautiful old Italian courtyard. And it's not like a festival where, you know, you're one of many bands and, like, each artist takes one night of a week of performances. And it's just really beautiful and really special and such a great idea, because you're surrounded by all this kind of beautiful architecture and there's something incredibly romantic about it, and I think it really suits my music.
That was Anna Calvi. Her new record, One Breath, is out now, and she's currently on tour across Europe. AnnaCalvi.com is where you'll find all the details.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina,
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay. From Monaco.
From Monaco.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monaco.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monaco. I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Back in the 1960s, pop music in Cambodia was coming into its own. Cambodian artists took Western pop, surf rock and even psychedelia and blended them with homegrown Khmer influences. But the experiment came to a crashing halt in 1975 when the Khmer Rouge came to power. Artists and musicians were especially targeted by the genocidal communist regime. Most died or fled the country. Now, decades later, a small group of young Cambodians are rediscovering their voices and forging something new. It's in the form of punk, metal and hardcore, genres completely unknown by most people in this traditional society. The first EP by a Cambodian hardcore group has just been released, and from the capital Phnom Penh, Carl James took a closer listen at this small but burgeoning scene.
Turn on a TV set in Cambodia, and you might just go into sugar shock. The channels are chock full of syrupy sweet Cambodian pop music videos.
Vung vinh vung von chit keng kut mình yul mình đang hát phol ni mul cha chaol bong.
They're extremely saccharine affairs that usually follow the same script. There's young love, adoring looks, and often a traffic accident, and then lots of weeping next to a hospital bed. And just like all those fake Louis Vuitton bags and knockoff iPhones for sale here, much of Cambodian music is copied, usually from Korea or other Asian countries, with Khmer lyrics added on. Vocalist Van Ten Hoorn can't deal with any of it.
Cambodia has lost its creativity in like a really long time, and then because people need to make money, so that's why people just like plagiarize stuff from other countries, and then so that's why I started this band, because I hate the idea of plagiarism. So yeah, I was like, why not just make our own stuff, and then something that I love to do.
What he loves to do is sing in his hardcore band, Slit and Six. Slit and Six is probably the best known of a handful of Khmer hardcore, punk, and metal bands that are treading very new ground in Cambodia these days. They met over a hardcore fan page and have no interest in playing mainstream pop. Instead, they're taking inspiration from music they found on the internet. Hardcore bands almost never make it to Cambodia on tour. Then they give the music their own spin. Van Tin, or Tin as he's better known, writes songs about contemporary Cambodian issues like meth addiction and even the Khmer Rouge. Then the 21-year-old gets in front of the mic and explodes.
It just feels great to, like, you know, do stuff that people don't really have never seen before. They're just like, what's going on? I'm just like, yeah. And most of the time I'm pretty drunk as well, so I don't really remember what it is.
Tin and his bandmates are often found at Showbox, a bar and club that's become a magnet for young Cambodian misfits in this conservative society. It's also one of the few places in town where Western expats and young Khmer people socialize. Miley Rattle runs Showbox. He came to Cambodia 2 years ago from Australia. He says he saw Slit and Six at a show in Phnom Penh and realized something new and interesting was going on. He opened his bar to be a part of it.
Music scene-wise, it's a microcosm of New York in the 60s. There's hardcore and there's punk and there's metal, and it's just uber new here.
He and a friend also opened Yab Mung Records, Cambodia's first alternative label. The name means pain in the ass in the Khmer language. The label signed two bands and is talking with two more. And it's just had its first issue, a Slit and Six EP.
This is the first EP in Cambodia ever recorded, alternative metal, hardcore, punk, anything. Ever recorded in Cambodia, ever released in Cambodia, ever made in Cambodia. Ever, you know? My idea is that in 10 years, there's going to be thousands of kids in bands like this because of these guys.
Today, Showbox is having a launch party for the EP. About 60 people have come for the afternoon show. It was supposed to start at 3, but by 3:30, most of the band members haven't shown up yet. Sam Rocker is the female vocalist for No Forever, a post-punk band that's opening the show. While Tin from Slit and Six might feel like an outcast, Sam's got it even harder. In Cambodia, girls are supposed to be feminine and demure, not screaming into a mic in front of a crowd. Sam says she doesn't care.
When I'm on stage, people was like looking at me and feel strange and wonder, what is she doing? What am I doing? It was like that, but I just don't care. I just want to show them, yeah, if they don't like me, just ignore me. But if you interested, yeah, that'd be great.
She says she's proud of what she does, but admits her parents still don't know. They do know that she's gay, and that's okay. But that she fronts a metal band, she hasn't dared broach that subject.
Actually, my parents don't realize I am in a metal band. That's why. And if they know, I don't know what is the consequences, I don't know.
All right, everybody. We've waited a long time to get this done.
The five members of Slit and Six take the stage, and lead singer Tin erupts. Screaming into the mic, he looks like a man possessed, or maybe just very drunk, since he's been downing beers and shots for a couple of hours before the show. His onstage persona is completely at odds with his delicate Khmer features. A few times he falls to the floor, singing in an almost fetal position, then jumps up, giving the crowd the finger. He's singing Nevermore, the song about the Khmer Rouge era. His father lost his entire family then. His mom was almost killed. Tin stumbles off the stage and back to the bar to enjoy a shot after the show. He says one of his goals is to wake up Cambodians. He wants them to take chances, stop just playing it safe. And many observers say young Cambodians are ready for this message. As the country develops, young people are taking charge of their own lives. They're enjoying more personal freedoms, even demanding more political ones. Still, in good hardcore fashion, Tin's pretty blasé about the band's success.
If we get big, that'll be great. But if we don't, whatever. It's just like we're doing the stuff that we love right now. And then like kind of just spread the message, like, whatever. Well, if we don't, we just say that, yeah, I've done something, yeah.
For Monocle, in Phnom Penh, I'm Kyle James.
You are tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Scott Stossel is editor of The Atlantic. He also suffers from crippling anxiety. He's just released a book all about it, and our new feature, What I'm Reading, we've given Boston Globe book critic Matthew Gilbert 90 seconds to tell us what he makes of it.
One of my favorite books so far this year is called My Age of Anxiety. It's by Scott Stossel, who is the editor of The Atlantic, and a hugely successful man who has terrible, debilitating, paralyzing anxiety, and has had it since he was a child. And the book is his journey to try to understand that better. And he gets very deep into his research, but always keeps it tied to his own experience. So it's a fascinating read. I dreaded it, and then I didn't want it to end. Like many people, I have my own anxiety issues. So the thought of sitting down with someone else's anxiety for 400 or so pages was not inviting. And I'm not a science guy. But in fact, he translates all of the science into very readable English and makes it understandable and ties it to his own story in a way that gives it poignance, really. He tells a few stories in the book that show just how unglamorous a panic attack can be. And he makes the reader care by sharing his own experience, by being so candid about his torment. You can't resist his honesty.
That was Boston Globe book critic Matthew Gilbert with our first edition of What I'm Reading, and you'll be hearing more of them in the coming weeks. Scott Stossel's My Age of Anxiety is out now and well worth a read by the sound of it. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Next week, a session from Basha Bulat and the fascinating story of African music legend William Onyebar. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and thanks as ever to The Machine, a machine for making bloody beautiful radio, that is Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week from her Midori House session and her new record, One Breath. This is Anna Calvi with Suddenly. Thanks for tuning in.
Touch and the spell, her eyes are so wide.